Thank you. I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me and organising this conference. I've certainly learned a lot. Actually, my initial inclination was to, going first on the second day, was to actually sort of say a few words about my reaction to some of yesterday's presentations, but I'll actually resist the temptation because I don't have much time. But all I will do is just perhaps refer to the first session yesterday, where the talk was given by Yves Santamaré, on deliberative democracy and participatory democracy and the contrast and the tension between them. Obviously, I'm talking today about deliberative democracy, but I think there are interesting connections between the two. A month ago, I was at the annual conference of the American Political Science Association in Seattle, and the presidential address was given by Carol Pateman, who is, of course, one of the best-known theorists of participatory democracy. And she was actually arguing for a revival of interest and applicability of participatory democracy, and she actually contrasted it with deliberative democracy. So that was her foil. So she was really sort of posing them as alternatives. But she had a very narrow framing of deliberative democracy. She essentially equated it with lay citizen forums. I will be talking a bit about such forums today, but we should not make the mistake of, which I think she did, of equating deliberative democracy with such forums. My own feeling is that it's actually, well, it's certainly possible to be a deliberative democrat without being a participatory democrat. We can, some theorists of deliberative democracy seek deliberation in legislatures, in courts, in the standard institutions of the liberal state, and are not necessarily interested in participation. However, I actually think it's very hard to be a participatory democrat without also being a deliberative democrat. Why is this? Because otherwise, the danger is that participation is going to be of a very thin kind of character. Now, this also means that deliberative democracy must reach out to make itself applicable to participatory contexts. And to do that, you have to, I think, dispense with some of the sort of the old stereotypes about deliberative democracy, that it prizes argumentation above other forms of communication, that it seeks consensus, that its regulative ideal is consensus of some sort. I think we need to, deliberative democrats really do need to let go of both of those things. And if you look at the way the theory has developed over the last 10 or 15 years, we have let go. Some of the critics haven't noticed, but deliberative democrats are not committed to consensus as a regulative ideal. We do not prize rational argumentation above other forms of communication. Okay, so that's just by way of background. Okay, my topic today is global democracy. We might ask, well, what can participation possibly have to do at the global level? My response to that would be that all the justifications for democracy, all the standard justifications, apply at the global level, no less than anywhere else. If authority is increasingly shifting from the level of the nation state to global institutions, often to the impersonal forces of the global political economy, then democracy has to shift that level too. There are some skeptical political theorists, Robert Dahl being the most prominent one, who deny that global democracy is possible on the grounds that the prerequisites that we find in the nation state are not present there, prerequisites such as a well-defined demos, a sense of national solidarity. I think that kind of argument is just, it's almost not even worth responding to, because I think the only worthwhile question is how do we do it, not whether we do it. Otherwise, we're leaving just a huge source of really important authority in today's world beyond the reach of democracy, and I think that is simply unacceptable. So the question is how. The arguments, as I say, the justifications for democracy, the general justifications of democracy, apply at the global level as much as any other level. These justifications include legitimacy. Legitimacy depends on the degree of democracy in the production of collective outcomes. Of course, deliberative democrats have a particular take on legitimacy, that it requires deliberation on the part of those affected by a collective decision or their representatives. The second justification is simply rationality. Arguably, democracy is the best way for integrating diverse perspectives on complex issues. And the third claim, perhaps a bit more contentious, is that if we seek global global justice, then we also are going to need global democracy. This comes, I won't go into the details on that, there's a, recent book by Amartya Sen, which is called The Idea of Justice, which tries to draw the links between justice and democracy, deliberative democracy in particular, even though he doesn't call it that, and also tries to apply this to the global level. Okay, so how then do we think about global democracy and global deliberative democracy in particular? I think there are actually a number of ways of doing this. Surprisingly, quite a lot of ways. These are at least five ways. I'm not going to talk about all of them just because of reasons of time. We can think, and I'm actually going to dismiss two of them. Perhaps the most straightforward way of thinking about global democracy would be to think of it in terms of the image of the liberal democratic state. Some people do this. For example, Raphael Marchetti, in a book a couple of years ago, really sort of see something like a global state as being necessary if we seek global democracy. Obviously, that's a very long way from existing global reality. My own view is that this is just so far distant from the reality of the contemporary international system that it's not actually a very worthwhile way to think about global democracy. The second way we can think about it is as a forum, or rather think about introducing global level forums into the system. And I will actually have a bit to, I will talk about that. That's why the asterisk is by that one. The third way is what I, this is in a recent article called Soup, Society and System, which was published in Ethics and International Affairs. I called a soup. This is really the idea of a soup is essentially a minimalist approach to global democracy. Instead of seeing any kind of overarching logic at the system level, what it does is it just sees a variety of accountability practices emerging at different locations in the global political economy. We associate that position in particular with Michael Saward, who's a British political theorist who wrote actually he's originally from Australia, but he's in Britain now. He wrote an article a couple of years ago called "Instead of Global Democracy." So he's thinking that these multiple disconnected practices it make more sense, and we should just look at those in isolation, and they don't add up to anything, and they don't presage any sort of grander development towards global democracy. I'm going to dismiss that simply on the grounds that, it really is hard to know what to make of this. If we're interested in democratization of the global polity, then just sort of seeing it in terms of a disconnected soup of practices is I think not enough. The fourth possibility here is as a society. International society. I could use some more slides here. Okay, that was the other theorist of a soup is James Rosenau. The fourth framing, society. This looks at international society as featuring a set of constitutive norms and discourses that can be targets of democratization. I actually wrote about this in a book that I published 5 years ago now called Deliberative Global Politics. In that book, I stressed global democratization in terms of the democratization of the interplay, the engagement of discourses in global public spheres. This can actually be connected to theories in the weird and wonderful world of international relations theory, in particular constructivism and the so-called English school of international relations. Both of these see the importance of constitutive norms and discourses in ordering the global system. What I would say is that with time, there is actually a process of sort of reflexive modernization that we can see at the global level in which there's a decline in hegemonic discourses, there's an increase in contestation of discourses, and so the challenge comes to be how to think about democratizing that contestation. But I'm going to skate over that for the purposes of today's presentation, and I'm actually going to focus on the idea of a forum introducing a particular kinds of forum at the global level, and also the idea of a deliberative system, which resonates very strongly with recent developments in the theory of deliberative democracy. In my last book, Foundations of Frontiers of Deliberative Governance, I actually spoke about the systemic turn in deliberative democracy, the turn towards deliberative systems, actually away from thinking about single forums. But I'm going to talk about single forums first. And the reason I'm going to do this is not because I think any particular forum is going to produce deliberative democracy, but that the injection of particular kinds of forums into the system may help when it comes to deliberative democratization. So these may be incremental moves, and they may leave us far from any ideal, but I think it's still worth thinking about these sorts of these kinds of initiatives. What I'm going to do is actually contrast a proposal for a deliberative citizens forum. We can call it a mini-public, as several people yesterday referred to mini-publics. Although a mini-public at the macro, not macro scale, but at the grand scale, at the global level. Obviously, nothing like this has ever been attempted, although, as I will suggest, there are intimations of this. There are hints that this could actually be done. The existing proposals, though, that are much more prominent, feature something very different. They feature something like a parliament. There's a fairly high-profile campaign for the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, UNPA. And this campaign has been joined. It's got a website. It's got high-profile officials, including UN officials, many elected officials, heads of state, heads of government from different countries who have endorsed the proposal. The reason I put a question mark after elected is that although its proponents see election to this global parliamentary assembly as a long-term goal, they realize that in the short term it's not feasible. There are, of course, a number of authoritarian states which are members of the UN. And so in the short term, it actually involves a lot in the way of appointment by national governments rather than direct elections, which is a long-term aspiration. Let me just go over a few problems with this proposal and why I think a deliberative global citizens assembly, a global mini-public, might actually do better on some of these dimensions. And the first problem is the cultural specificity of elections. Elections are tied to Western notions of democracy. Amartya Sen, again, has pointed out that democracy as elections is very much a Western construct, but democracy as deliberation or discussion is much more universal, manifested in different ways in different cultures, but more universal nevertheless. There are specific problems with transnational elections. Just look at the problems we have with the elections to the European Parliament, which are generally not fought on European issues. People vote, it's often more of a more to pass judgment on the performance of their national governments, so they're not fought they're not fought on European issues, and often they provide a venue for people's expressive preferences. To use the language of my colleague Geoffrey Brennan and Lauren Lemaski, expressive preferences can be ethical, but they can prejudices of various kinds. But the reason people give vent to their expressive preferences in European elections is precisely because they view them as the result as inconsequential, that the result does not actually give you a government of any kind. So there are specific problems with transnational elections, which are likely to be magnified at the global level. A United Nations Parliamentary Assembly might look like a national parliament which only had representatives of regional parties with regional concerns. Right. A bit like the Parliament of Belgium, only on a global scale. Okay, there's a China problem. China does not like elections, does not like national elections, would probably not agree to global elections. There's a United States problem, equally severe. American politicians do not accept the possibility of any level of authority above that of that established in the U.S. Constitution. That is why I said that there are many officials around the world who have endorsed the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly campaign, but there is not one single mainstream American politician who has done so. Now, why would a deliberative citizens' assembly do better? The basic idea here of such an assembly would be, as I say, like a mini public. It would be organized on the basis of something like random selection, but on a global basis. There are many domestic precursors. There are actually some transnational and even one global precursor. The transnational precursors can be found in Europe, with the Europolis deliberative opinion poll conducted by James Fishkin and his associates a couple of years ago. The global precursor is something called Worldwide Views. This is a process, a deliberative citizen process, was conducted on a national basis, but in 38 countries on the same day, September the 26th, 2009, in the lead up to the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. It was the same process, 38 countries, same day, 100 randomly selected citizens convened to produce, well, actually not exactly convened to produce a set of recommendations, but convened to answer a questionnaire about their reaction to and their support for various proposals to deal with climate change. So that's one precursor. That wasn't actually a transnational deliberation because all the deliberations were national. What the organizers should have done but didn't was take one or more representative from each of those 38 countries who participated in the deliberation in each one of them, bring them to Copenhagen, have them deliberate there, and then produce, have it run it as an event in parallel with the official UN negotiations, but they didn't. And so that was perhaps a missed opportunity. The idea is it would be deliberative as well as a citizens' forum, and so it would require facilitation, and it would require, of course, a lot in the way of simultaneous translation. But that, well, as we know from this conference, that can be done, however difficult it would be on a multilateral level. Why would it do better in terms of the problems that I've indicated? Cultural specificity. Well, discussion, deliberation is less culturally specific than elections, as Sen has pointed out. Instead of getting transnational elections with voting on irrelevant grounds and expressive voting, we would have very consequential selection processes. Ideally, people would take their role seriously, as we know they do in existing citizen forums, and be there as citizens of the world rather than as representatives of political parties in particular countries, which is likely what you get with elections. The hope would be, just as we know from ordinary citizen forums, nationally organized, that we would get a prioritization of concerns with the long term and with public goods, as we see in existing citizen forums. In terms of the China problem, the hierarchy of the Chinese Communist Party has been surprisingly open to experiments in at least local experiments in deliberation in China. And some of the leading figures in that hierarchy have even given speeches on deliberative democracy. This is actually a bit of a worry. It's a very ambiguous development, to say the least. But at least it means perhaps that China might be less likely to object to this kind of process than to elections. The United States problem might be ameliorated. It's actually perhaps a bigger one than the China problem, because it's an in principle objection to global authority of any sort, not just a global parliament, elected global parliament. But perhaps a citizens' assembly would look sufficiently different than a legislature to make it look less like a challenge to the authority established in the US Constitution. That's a bit speculative. Okay. Let me now move to the idea of a system, deliberative system in particular. It's important to emphasize that a mini public is not a deliberative democracy. There are some deliberative democrats, especially enthusiasts and designers of citizen forums, who make that mistake. But I think it's best to see citizen forums as potentially just one part of the more general architecture of a deliberative system. Yesterday in his comments on the first session, Luigi Bobbio made exactly the same point, that we should regard citizens' juries, for example, as just one part of a deliberative system. This is, as I said, consistent with the recent systemic turn in deliberative democracy. The idea of a deliberative system was first introduced by Jane Mansbridge 12 years ago, and it's been developed by a number of people, including John Parkinson, Caroline Hendricks, actually both of whom were students of mine, and both of whom got to the idea of a deliberative system before I did. And the idea of a deliberative system is that rather than seeking deliberative democracy in any particular forum, be it a parliament, a citizens' forum, or anything else, or indeed in just the public sphere, in just the interplay of actors, discourses in the public sphere, we should instead look for interlinked yet differentiated components which together can make a deliberative democracy. Now, in Mansbridge's original presentation, these components are very much geared to the presence of a liberal state. So she saw a deliberative system as reaching from everyday talk amongst friends, within families, in cafes, whatever, reaching for everyday talk to more formal deliberation in the legislature. But we can actually take the idea of a deliberative system and generalize it so it's applicable in contexts beyond the state, including the global context. So what then should we look for in any deliberative system? These are just some of the main elements that I think we should look for in any deliberative system, and we can apply this at any level, from the local to the global. Public space, really the public sphere, where we seek the relatively sort of free-flowing interchange of ideas, discourses, and so forth. Empowered space of public authority. This can be the formal institutions of a state, or it can take other forms, especially in the global system. It can also at the national level, when we're talking about things like network governments, for example. But in the global system, it might take the form of, for example, multilateral negotiations. It might take the form of various forms of network governance, which can apply globally. It might even take the form of states. It's possible to imagine a global deliberative system in which the authority to act is still exercised by states. So we could imagine a transnational or a global public sphere involving much in the way of global interchange, coexisting with public authority still exercised by states. And obviously what large states do, China, the US in particular, matters enormously when it comes to consequences for global outcomes. I might say a bit about climate change in a few moments, but of course what they do matters tremendously there. We also need some kind of transmission from public space to empowered space, and this can come in many forms. Within the state, it often takes the form of electoral politics of various sorts, but there are many other means through which transmission can be exerted. Communicative means, the power of argument, the power of rhetoric, and so forth. Electoral means are not available in the global system, but the non-electoral means are. Accountability, again, is sort of, when in terms of national parliamentary governance, we think of it in terms of electoral accountability for the most part, but accountability just means, the ability to give an account. And so we can seek accountability mechanisms in global politics, no less than in national politics. And then we can also seek what Dennis Thompson has called meta-deliberation. This is really the reflexive capacity of the system to somehow deliberate about its own qualities, its own shortcomings in particular, and how they might be rectified. In the few minutes left, I might just talk very briefly about the global governance of climate change. Actually, I'd happily talk about this for 3 hours rather than just 3 minutes. So I've been doing a lot of work on this over the last couple of years, and I'm in the process of co-authoring a book on this. And here we actually do try. My co-author here is Hayley Stevenson. We do actually try to apply this idea of a deliberative system to the global governance of climate change, to use a deliberative system as a template by which to both describe, evaluate, and suggest some improvements to the global governance of climate change. So just very briefly, how does the global governance of climate change look in these deliberative system terms? First, public space. In some ways, it's quite healthy. We see a variety of discourses, ranging from climate marketization through to climate justice to a discourse of denial. But often, this sheer variety doesn't necessarily lead to engagement across different discourses. There are enclaves in which different discourses are present. The Klima Forum, which is the civil society forum conducted in parallel with UN negotiations. In that forum, we get a discourse of green radicalism that dominates, with radical versions of climate justice as well, but not the kinds of discourses of ecological modernization, climate marketization that we find, for example, in the World Business Summit on various World Business Summits on climate change. When we look at empowered space, at the multilateral negotiators in particular, they feature a lot of bargaining, some real deliberation. We've done a lot of interviews with participants. Unfortunately, the story is not necessarily a very happy one, that one veteran negotiator I interviewed seemed to think that the deliberative quality of those negotiations actually declined over the last 15 years or so. In the 90s, the general ethos was, we the world can cope with this collective problem. Now, national interests are much more dominant than partial interests. There are multiple channels for transmission. Civil society activists are actually physically present at the multilateral negotiations. Whether they're heard or not is a different question. Often they're heard much more readily by negotiators from small states who use civil society organization representatives as sources of information and expertise, sometimes even as sources of negotiators. A number of Pacific Islands, for example, use Australian activists as their negotiators within the UN forum. That's just one channel. There are multiple ones. But some discourses don't make it through. Green radicalism, for example, tends not to make it from the public sphere to the official negotiations. Some discourses make it much more easily, for example, ecological modernization and climate marketization. There is some narrative accountability in the system. For example, government negotiators often give briefings to their own NGOs and media. Little deliberative accountability. There's very little two-way interchange that goes on. Very weak meta-deliberative capacity. Climate change has never had its Bretton Woods moment, where the global financial system was created after World War II. Instead, the system has gradually accumulated over time and has accumulated some real oddities in democratic, in any terms, in terms of reaching any kind of decisive agreement. And finally, any deliberation that does occur, the deliberative system that is present, is not decisive. That when it comes to global outcomes, most of what goes on globally that's consequential for climate change is not affected by what goes on in that deliberative system. Partly as a result of the failure to reach any comprehensive multilateral agreement, partly due to the fact that agreements that are reached, for example, the Copenhagen Accord at the last minute 2 years ago, was reached as a bargain between a small number of players, which essentially ignored any prior deliberation that occurred. Okay, that's a very very short story. That's the 3-minute version. The 3-hour version is much more extensive. And also involves just a number of moves that could be made to improve the global governance of climate change in deliberative terms. That wouldn't necessarily guarantee we would get effective global action on climate change, but it would, I would argue, help contribute to a more effective global response. So the general point then is that deliberative thinking in particular is applicable at the global level, that we can think of global democracy productively in deliberative terms. There are a number of options for doing this. So when it comes to global democracy, we shouldn't, as a skeptic say, just give up on the idea that it's obviously, you know, that it's too remote, that the preconditions don't exist. I think the only question is how do we do it rather than whether we do it. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.